Imagine a world where innovation knows no bounds. At BAE Systems Fast Labs, we're pioneering advanced technology and defense research, shaping the future of safety and security. Explore our website to uncover a realm of cutting-edge projects, collaborations, and visionary thinkers. Whether you're a tech enthusiast, a defender of freedom, or just curious, Fast Labs is where groundbreaking solutions are born. Join us and be part of the future today. Visit www.baesystems.com/fastlabs. Welcome to From the Crow's Nest, a podcast on electromagnetic spectrum operations, or EMSO. I'm your host, Ken Miller, Director of Advocacy and Outreach for the Association of Old Crows. Thanks for joining us, and especially thank you for joining us for this new subscriber edition of From the Crow's Nest. We began this new episode series a couple months ago, and right now, if you're here in the audience or listening to it after we've released the episode tomorrow on Wednesday, March 20th, you'll know that it is currently free to everyone, but we are working to put these episodes behind a paywall, which will only be accessible to our very special subscribers as well as AOC members. So if you are neither, I encourage you to go to crows.org and look into becoming an AOC member, or when we put the episodes behind the paywall, you can become a subscriber for $2.99 a month. But I want to welcome everyone here in the audience today. For those of you joining us, this is an opportunity for you not just to watch us record this episode, but also to participate. So we welcome your participation via the chat function on your screen. You can introduce yourselves, say hi to us. We cannot see you, and we do not know who you are unless you go into the chat. But you can go into the chat, introduce yourself if you want, ask a question, give a comment, or say anything you want, and we'll recognize that throughout the episode. We have a lot to cover today, so I wanted to introduce my very special guests. First and foremost is friend and colleague, Dr. Tom Withington. He is editor, defense commentator, journalist, and military historian with Armada. Alongside here, I also have Matt Thompson, who is AOC's senior analyst, and of course, he's been on the show again before, and we welcome him back to help us with the discussion. So, gentlemen, thank you for joining me here on From the Crow's Nest. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks so much, Ken. Great to be with you both. Looking forward to today's discussion.
Thanks, Ken. It's good to be back.
Well, Tom, it's great to have you on. You know, we were talking yesterday. It's been a few months, or almost a year, since we've had you on the show. We had you on during AOC Europe last year. But it's always good to see you. You're definitely by far the best dressed guest I ever have on the show. And so I didn't even put forth an effort today to match that. So I've got the sweatshirt on, but really appreciate you taking time to join us and always looking good as always.
You're such a flatterer, Ken. Of course, it's all style over content. You see, this is the thing.
Now, for those who might not be familiar with you, you're coming, joining us from across the Atlantic over in Europe. Where are you joining us from here? Because I know it's probably better weather than we're having here on the East Coast.
So I'm joining you from the fair city of Toulouse in southwest France today. We've got a beautiful day, as you can maybe see from outside the window here. I think spring has finally arrived. Although that being said, a usual behavior of the southwestern weather is you get a very fine March. When it comes to an end in February thereabouts, you get a very fine March. And then the rains come in April and May. So what we're currently seeing is the theater trailer of coming soon to a weather system near us. That's the nice weather that hopefully we'll see in the summer. And I'll try and send some of it to you folks on the East Coast as well.
Yeah, well, I think our first day of spring here is coming. I think it's today or tomorrow. I can't remember the actual date, but it feels more like winter out here. And from the East Coast, Pennsylvania, we're above freezing at least, but still hasn't seemed to kick in yet. So I'm a bit jealous, and I don't feel bad for your quickly approaching rainy season. So it looks great out there. Matt, it's good to have you on the show again. Also, you've been on the road quite a bit here. You went to AOC's Point Magoo conference on collaborative EW last week. And we also had a a workshop down in San Antonio on kind of advanced EW readiness, technology and readiness. So it's great to have you back in your office and joining us here. So how are you doing?
Yeah, it's good. It's good to take a little break. You know, obviously next week I'm heading back to EW Dixie Crow. So, you know, lots of travel. But as you said, my weather is pretty good today. It's a little cool, but we had good weather for, you know, the San Antonio region. And I guess the positive from the EW Collaborative Symposium is it didn't get rained out like last year. So that's a win.
Good. Well, we have a lot to get to. There's a lot of, you know, the purpose of these episodes, these bonus episodes, is to really kind of take a look at the headlines, what's going on around the world, what's capturing our attention, just kind of talk about where we see IMSO fitting into the larger puzzle. To begin, though, you know, Matt, you know, I mentioned in my introduction to you, you did just have run a workshop on EW readiness down in San Antonio a couple weeks ago. I was there. It was a great event. We had about 50 people, 50 stakeholders from San Antonio region. Could you tell us a little bit about that workshop and kind of what are some of the main ideas that you brought out of that workshop that you're working on now as you prepare your readout?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, it had been a few years since there had been a good event like that down here in San Antonio, probably before COVID, I would say. And there's a significant number of like EW assets, both academically, government and industry. So, you know, it was a good opportunity to get all those people back together in the same room and kind of start, you know, getting that ball of motion going, starting to put some things on the calendar. So we had a couple of really good discussions about, you know, one, just the assets that are here and how many there really are. I think it was eye-opening for a lot of people. And then we delved into some you know, more topics that actually fed really nicely into the next week out in Point Magoo. You know, we talked about some future assets and abilities that are out there. Talked about machine learning and AI, which is obviously a really hot topic right now. So overall, I'm putting up the finishing touches on a report out. Basically, we had some breakout sessions in the afternoon. So we had about five groups, and I have three of the feedback from them, and I'm waiting on two, and then we'll be putting out a pretty good solid report for everybody.
Great. Well, so what were some of the main themes that were discussed? I know we heard from 16th Air Force, we heard from some other folks, and obviously a lot of the conversation was on that joint perspective, and I then want to bring in Tom because I think when we talk joint EW, it's not just about the U.S. services, but also joint and collaborative or a cooperative EW with our partners across in Europe. So, what were some of the specific things that you heard?
Yeah, so the real big thing that we were focused on was kind of twofold. One, how do we handle and how do we manage MSO and EW going forward with specifically manpower and resource like limitations. Both there's, you know, a significant limitation on training for people as well as, you know, and a limitation on the number of total people. So how do we get those people to work better? How do we work more efficiently? How do we still like try to manage the work that we're doing? That was really a really big afternoon theme. And then the other one is just, you know, how do we get those assets to work more collaboratively? You know, it was very evident that even, and I don't want to admit to San Antonio, I think it's kind of true across the board that everyone has their kind of stovepipe piece and it's really hard to get all of those entities to work together. But it's really something we need to strive for. So those are the two really big themes for the day.
And so, Tom, you know, what are some of the things? What are some of the topics that you've been looking into in your writings in your efforts over there? And can you talk a little bit about some of the challenges you see, particularly as it pertains to manpower and readiness, which was a hot topic at the workshop?
Sure. I mean, I'd like to sort of echo some of the themes I think that Matt brought up just now, that whole question that we're facing about jointness. And I'm sure that some of the issues that we're facing in Europe are very, very similar to the ones that you're facing on the other side of the pond. Jointness is almost assumed two separate yet interrelated strands, if you like. I mean, on one hand, there's the intra-force jointness that we're seeing domestically. So where I live in France or, you know, where the old country is back in the UK, so to speak, how do the forces in these countries collaborate in the electromagnetic space? How do we improve our ability to move information, move data between forces? But then we're also operating now in the multi-domain operations mindset, it's becoming increasingly important. So we need to link out also to our allied forces, to yourselves, obviously, in the US, to other NATO forces, other allied forces around the world, for instance, the AUKUS initiative that's becoming important now with Australia, the US and the UK. What provisions do we have in place there to ease and facilitate the movement of EW and EMSO specific data? I think this is an interesting question because it gets into another area, which is, Matt, you talked just now, for instance, about the whole issue of stovepiping. And I think in the EW domain, this is something we've been very used to for a long time. It's almost, in a sense, the default setting because what we deal with is very, very sensitive, often very secret data. Even allies don't always like to share this data between forces, let alone between allies. So how do we get around that? How do we preserve that all-important confidentiality, the secrecy, the security that we so desperately need, while at the same time helping to facilitate the sort of joint approach to EMSO? So I think it's interesting that you're very obviously engaged in that conversation in the US. And I think we're getting that similar momentum in Europe now as well. NATO is a great facilitator for that, of course. But I think as we look to the future, we need to continue to deepen that conversation between ourselves. And it's got to always be at the forefront of our minds. That's the thing. What I don't want it to become is a sort of thing where it's a hot topic for 2024 and we all talk about this and we move on to something else. It has to have an air of permanence to it. So that's one of the big areas that I'm looking at and have a great interest in at the moment.
And trying to get that sustained advocacy has always been elusive for our community because, you know, we'll make progress in certain areas, we'll see things start to come together, and then either force of nature or something will happen either globally or bureaucratically, and we just kind of lose that momentum. You know, I was reminded as you were talking, you know, last week I had on my guests were Katie and Madison. We were talking about what's going on in Congress, and of course the president's budget just come out, his budget request, and you know, on the surface, the talking points, it sounds fine. It sounds great. You know, a little bit more money than last year, you know, key priorities and so forth. But when you kind of dig into it and read some of the analysis behind it, two of the things that kind of popped up was just this idea of the lack of unified pathways or strategies on a number of important things that are critical to future EMSO, being space being one, as well as kind of how are we addressing the UAV problem, you know, in terms of the problem and the opportunity. You have different service priorities, you have different service different services dedicating certain amounts to programs and maybe not developing them fast enough. In space, there's just a lot of holes in terms of, on one hand, they tout its importance, but then it's underfunded in so many critical areas for controlling the EMS in space. So how do we, from your perspective, Tom, you've written on this a lot over the years. What are a couple of the things that are on your mind that like we need to be really focused in on kind of moving forward so that we can get the sustained advocacy in the right places like space or UAV technology or so forth?
I think one of the things that we can do, and I think we're doing it actually as a community, is moving the conversation into the non-specialist domain, if you like. I mean, we're increasingly seeing events globally that are shaping how people who are not necessarily in the EMSO domain are thinking about it and realizing the impact it can have. I'll give you an example from last week, actually. You folks might not have heard about this in the US, but the Secretary of Safer Defense, Grant Shapps, who, you know, is our defense minister in the UK, he was returning from a visit to see NATO troops in Poland. And on the way back, his official aircraft flew in proximity to Kaliningrad, the Russian exclave that sits there between Poland and Lithuania. The aircraft never violated Russian airspace, but its systems were affected by Russian GPS jamming. Now, there's no hint, for instance, that the Russians were doing this deliberately. It's an open secret. It's well documented in social media that GNSS, Global Navigation Satellite System jamming, is routinely performed from Kaliningrad. And it's ostensibly done by Russian forces there to protect their assets against GPS-guided weaponry. It is a force protection asset. Yet it can have unfortunate nuisance consequences when it is being used, and it was being used that day. Why it was being used, we don't know. Quite possibly a training exercise, perhaps maintenance, who knows? Anyway, his aircraft was affected. Now, the aircraft continued its flight safely, landed back in the UK. Nobody was hurt, nobody was injured, nothing untoward or terrible happened. But what it did do was it got people thinking in the sort of, in general society, if you like, in the community, about the impact of such things as this. Now, you know, in the BBC, who I did some interviews for, the phrase EMSO never came up. But nevertheless, we were having an EMSO conversation. We were talking about the impact of this GNSS jamming on our lives and what that may be in the future. So I think part of the increasing the political and the societal awareness, if you like, of EMSO and understanding this isn't just a military problem, this is something that can affect all of our societies and we need to prepare for it, is, I think, being able to exploit events when they do happen and when they're picked up by the media around the world is a good starting point to do that. And one of the best ways of explaining things to people is real-world examples, isn't it? If you've got something that illustrates something, GNSS jamming or an EMP blast, for instance, from a high-altitude nuclear device, then you get people thinking. By getting people thinking, you get them to have the conversation and get them to consider these kind of things. So that's a big part of it for me, I think.
There was an article in Newsweek talking about a U.S. Reaper drone also, you know, having to make an emergency landing amid some GPS attacks. And, you know, it's that inability to really be, we were talking about yesterday, you know, kind of the way that GPS jamming operates, you can't really target it in the same way. So it's really kind of an easy way for Russia to kind of hide behind, oh, it's just happening. You know, it's a shame that it was affected the aircraft, but it's very hard to kind of pinpoint what was going on. Matt, I wanted to bring you in on this this topic as well. Before I do, though, for those members who are joining us in the audience, you might notice that we occasionally have some rough internet connection, and you know, it's undoubtedly the beautiful weather in Toulouse that can be interrupting some of Dr. Withington's some of his feed. So, just want to let you know the way that this works and this operates is we record directly on to our computers, and then it gets uploaded at the end of the show. So what you hear as kind of a break in some of his words and so forth will not actually appear on the episode that is released tomorrow. It's recording locally on his computer, and then we upload it. And so if you feel like you're missing something, please go ahead and tomorrow when we release the episode, download it and listen to it. It'll sound like it never happened. So just, you know, be patient and bear with us on that. But also, if you have any questions on these topics, feel free to go into the chat and ask away, and I'll share it with the guests. So Matt, I wanted to bring you in on what Dr. Withington was talking about in terms of GPS jamming. I don't know if you saw the article here. It's a U.S. Reaper drone in emergency landing amid Russia GPS attacks. But, you know, what is some of your take on what you're hearing on that front?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not surprising, right? So, first, I think there's a few misconceptions about GPS jamming out there, just kind of how it works and kind of what happens. You know, it was obviously a pretty good topic discussion over the last few weeks. I did have a journalist from Reuters reach out to me to kind of talk about, because it's affecting commercial airliners, you know, so it's not really, directed kind of energy. It's more just kind of, energy in all directions. So it definitely affects a lot of airplanes. I also think it's GPS comes from space, right? So by the time it gets here, you know, however many miles, the source is really small. So it doesn't take a significant amount of power to kind of override GPS. I mean, you've seen it driving in your car when you're in the forest, like, so it's, you know, pretty easy source to jam. I think the problem is that we've taken a lot of steps to really take advantage of the technology in a lot of different ways, both, you know, in the civilian world as well as the DOD, And now we're kind of have to backpedal a little bit because we've become a little too reliant on it. And it's just showing us some opportunities where, you know, maybe we need to be able to deal with those situations a little better than we are. So at the very least, it's probably good training and recognition that it's happening to us. But it's also happening at a time where arguably, at least, you know, for the United States and maybe for, you know, Europe, it's not a huge deal. You know, if we were in a conflict, you know, it can be significantly a larger factor than maybe it is now. So hopefully we realize some good training opportunities out of it.
And one of the things that we can do is you know, incorporate and train it with a little bit more redundancy. So if we do know that it is happening, we have other ways that we can mitigate that loss in information and loss in direction, that we have other systems that we can use. What are some of the things that we can do specifically, whether it's redundancy training, that could help mitigate some of the challenges that are posed by GPS? I'll turn it back to Tom here to keep the conversation going.
It's a good question, Ken. I mean, I think it takes a layered approach, really, and that's one of the things that I'm hearing from the doyens of GPS is that there's not really a silver bullet that's going to solve the whole problem. It's a combination of technology, of looking for alternatives to GNSS that we can use. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency in the US is doing a lot of work in this area. All kinds of weird and wonderful techniques that it's looking at, even things like sensing the Earth's magnetic fields at certain points on the planet and developing individual signatures that will tell you where you are based on the strength of that magnetic field. I mean, that's just one technology that's being looked at. There seems to be a further embrace of inertial navigation systems that don't really depend on any external radio frequency sources. I mean, they're already very advanced bits of kit, but that technology will continue to improve. A lot of work's going on, for instance, looking at atomic clocks and timing sources. It's often overlooked, actually, I think, beyond our community. But one of the most important things that GPS does is provide a timing signal. You know, I'm always telling people this when they're using GPS for navigation, that's the key thing. You're getting a timing signal, and then through very sophisticated mathematics and triangulation, all those kind of things, you're working out where you are. So there's scope for miniaturized advanced timing systems that you can use with inertial navigation systems, for instance, to sort of get around some of the dependence that we may have on GNSS. And I think the other thing is, as Matt mentioned it just now, which is thinking about how we also conduct our daily lives, and that extends to how militaries fight. It's important to emphasize militaries have been fighting for a lot longer than there has been GPS. It's a very new invention. D-Day was fought entirely without a single email being sent or GPS being used. Same with the US landings in the Pacific Islands, again, done without GPS. So it is possible to do it. And I think, I suppose one of the important things from a tactical perspective is perhaps not to assume you're going to have it. You know, it's a nice thing if it's there, but assume you won't have it. It's a bit like the thing with MCON, isn't it? Assume that your communications are being eavesdropped on. Assume someone is going to try and jam them, and then work everything from there. I mean, as a bit of a comic aside, I use GPS quite a lot whenever I'm going somewhere. And invariably, if I'm with my partner in the car and I'm you know, I'm nav and she's pilot, so to speak, I'm using the GPS. And when I get it wrong, she always unwisely says to me, why didn't you just bring a map with you and a calculator and a stopwatch? You know, just why didn't you use that method? And it's a good point. But of course, it's the ease of use, isn't it, that forces us to fall back on it. So I think, you know, long answer to your question, Ken, but in short, a combination of technologies, reducing reliance, and looking at alternative techniques. I think that's the way we approach this.
Yeah, so I just want to go back to that. Yeah, so, you know, when I was in the Navy, we trained all the time for being in a GPS-denied environment. Like we knew that was a very likely scenario. So, you know, there are techniques and ways to like share the time that you're talking about. There's a lot of things we mitigated those situations. We trained to that. I think the scenarios that made me more nervous is when we didn't know that we were getting GPS jammed, right? Because then your solutions are off. Maybe your INS that you mentioned, Tom, is not correct. You know, your weapons are degraded and you're unaware. Like that's a more scary scenario. But if you know you're getting GPS jammed, like we have places, things in, that we can manage that. Like that's not a big deal. And as you said, you just get the Atlas out of the car, you know, you use the stopwatch. Like there's ways around those things. I think that, you know, I don't want to use the word lazy. Complacent is probably more accurate, but we've just got a little complacent, I think, you know, with some assumptions that GPS would be there when we needed it. And, you know, maybe it's, you know, we just need to get back and tighten up our skills a little bit and realize we can work without it. Like it's not required. We just got to get better about it.
If I could just come in for a second on that, Ken. I mean, actually, a quick question for you, Matt, because I'm interested in this, which is, what, back in your Navy days, were they still teaching mariners how to use the sextant and do star readings and things like that? It's not a flippant question, but I mean, that's a skill, isn't it? And it's a useful alternative.
Yeah. So I think there's still some of that, right? I mean, there's arguably like better tools out there than just the sextant, but I mean, we always have one on the ship. Like it's not a skill that's gone away. You know, I would say that like most navigators are probably not using it, but we have, you know, stars and other things that we can use other than GPS. Like there's a lot of other tools out there. You know, but I think that there are definitely a fair amount of sailors that if all else failed, you could break out the sextant and probably be okay.
It's interesting, I think, with the incident that happened last week involving Mr. Shapp's aircraft, that his plane made it safely back to London. There were no problems. And that really underscores the fact that pilots will always make sure they're not relying on one way of finding out where they are and where they're going. You know, that's a textbook case of ensuring that you do not have technological dependence in one area that could potentially be a showstopper. And I think there's something for us all to learn in that score. You know, let's look at the professions that rely on navigation and look at how they deal with not having this resource and take that as the cue, whether you're an Uber driver or whether you're commanding an Arleigh Burke class destroyer. The lessons are as applicable, I think.
Yeah, so I want to throw one more comment in and then I'll turn it back to Ken. I'm ready, sure he's ready to move on to another topic. But I don't know if you know, Tom, but I did a tour over in the UK in Lossiemouth flying Tornado GR4. So, you know, we used radar fixes on every single flight. Like we knew like specific places that we would need to scan and make sure that our navigation was tight. So, I mean, it was a very common thing, I think, both on both sides of the pond to not rely on GPS. So.
Well, thank you for that. Tom, did you have anything you wanted to add?
The only thing I would add is that when Matt and I, next time when we meet in the flesh, I'm buying the beers and he can tell me the Tornado Lossiemouth stories.
I'm sure he has quite a few of them. So hours of entertainment.
Hello, everyone. I want to take a short break to thank BAE Systems Fast Labs for the continued support for our From the Crow's Nest podcast. I am pleased to be here today with Bill Watson, Chief Scientist at BAE Systems Fast Labs. Bill, it's great to be here with you. Now, BAE Systems Fast Labs is BAE Systems Research and Development and Production Organization. Can you tell us a little bit about Fast Labs as well as your background?
Yes, and thank you for having me. BAE Systems Fast Labs is dedicated to innovating disruptive next-generation solutions for the critical defense and intelligence challenges. Of course, electronic warfare is one of our key focus areas, but in addition to that, we also do research in autonomy and AI, sensing and response, advanced microelectronics, communications, and navigation. I've been working in the RF, that is radio frequency research community, for over 20 years, a short time in the United States Air Force, followed by specific research and development. My work in the last 20 years has been singularly focused on DARPA research, and within the last 10 years at BAE Systems Fast Labs specifically. Technology we work on spans sensor processing to high-level sense-making, up to tactical and operational-level autonomy and decision-making support. And one of the key differentiators about BAE Fast Labs is the research that we do is intended to find its way to benefit the warfighter.
This has been an important topic through many of our recent episodes here on From the Crow's Nest. Can you talk a little bit more about that technology? And for our audience, how does it change or affect our EW capabilities that we're trying to field?
In our work with leading DoD customers like DARPA or AFRL, we focus on developing technologies that will advance future solutions, from overcoming today's challenges to developing technologies never before thought to be possible. We then transition our technology to fieldable products to benefit our warfighters through partnership with BAE Systems, Electronic Systems, product lines. As a specific example, I thought I'd use a movie you may or may not be familiar with. It was called Battle Los Angeles. It was from 2011. And in that movie, aliens had invaded. And what the characters in the movie found is that whenever they keyed their microphones on their radios, they could be easily geolocated and targeted. What the movie presented as science fiction for us is, in fact, science fact. This is the type of technology that we work on and exist today, where the physics meets the real world.
This sounds like absolutely fascinating work. What is the next area that you see for research and development? And if anyone is interested in learning more, how can they reach out to you?
Well, we can't say too much because of the sensitivity of our work, classification levels. But in Fast Labs, we are always working on the future state. No matter what the future threats are, we will continue to focus on solving the hardest problems to benefit the warfighter. If you're interested in more information about Fast Labs, you can connect with us on our website at basystems.com/fastlabs.
Well, thank you, Bill, for joining me here on From the Crow's Nest. And now it's time to get back to our show. So kind of moving on, but still staying, obviously, in this realm, talking about Russian EW. We shared an article that was in the New York Times a couple days ago. Russians seize advantage in electronic warfare, talking about what's going on in Ukraine-Russia war. And in the article, they mention how, Ukraine enjoyed a honeymoon period, quote unquote, enjoyed a honeymoon period with the self-detonating drones and that they used quite effectively. Russia has then since come up with the ability to counter them, and they seem to have turned the tables using electronic countermeasures that have become more formidable weapons after some years of honing their capabilities. So, and then the article goes on to mention that electronic warfare remains a hidden hand in much of the war. Like Ukraine's disadvantage in troop numbers and ammunition and supplies, Ukraine suffers in this area as well in comparison to Russia. Russia is, the article is making the case that Russia is quickly learning how to take whatever advantage Ukraine had in EW for a period of time, take that away from them, and of course, kind of start to gain some momentum. So what are your thoughts on what you're hearing from the Russia-Ukraine war, how the use of EW both by Ukraine and Russia, and what does this mean in terms of, where this war might go? Obviously, Ukraine is waiting for U.S. to step up and provide aid that it sorely needs. And I think over the last few months, we've seen the negative impact of a lack of support from the U.S. With Ukraine. So, they're waiting for aid. What are some of the things you're seeing that apply directly to the EMSO community? I'll start with you, Tom.
It's a very good question, Ken. I've been doing some work actually today on this very question for in preparation for the EW Europe event that we've got in Oslo in mid-May, where this is going to be one of the topics that we have under discussion. I would certainly concur with what was articulated in the Newsweek article. I mean, one of the things that I hear on the grapevine, so to speak, is that the Russians have got quite good at learning from their mistakes and then retooling and repurposing in order to avoid those mistakes or to exploit other areas of the spectrum. I think often within the NATO community and within the West more generally, there's a perception that Russian doctrine and Russian armed forces doctrine particularly is very, very rigid, that it's a set prescribed list of tactics, techniques, and procedures that must be adhered to on the battlefield. And there's very little scope for, if you like, commander creativity beyond that and initiative. But one of the things I've been hearing from the Ukraine Theater of Operations is that that is not perhaps as apt as it used to be. Some units tend to be very, very good at being creative in terms of the electronic warfare they are practicing. Other units tend to be more hidebound. It doesn't always seem to be uniform, but where you have a creative commander, it definitely makes its presence felt. One of the key things that I'm hearing is that certainly in the land tactical domain, the majority of EW that is being performed by both sides now is very much related to the drone war, that's the key thing. One figure I was told by a Ukrainian colleague was that about 90% of tactical electronic warfare that's occurring along the front line is related to either detecting drones or jamming them by hitting their radio links. And I expect that to continue. To come to your point regarding the support, Ukraine desperately needs support in the electromagnetic spectrum. And one of the things that I've been hearing quite often is it's not necessarily in the EW sphere about getting the kit. Supplies of EW kit to Ukraine have been quite good. A lot of the emphasis is on help the Ukrainians maximize domestic production, help Ukrainian factories, engineers, experts innovate the EW systems that the military needs and get them out of the factories and get them on the front line. It mirrors, in a sense, the British experience during the Second World War in the early stages, where one of the key things that the UK benefited from was the US helping set up producing armaments in the US, but also supporting industrial know-how and helping to maximize production in the UK of the material that's desperately needed. I think the point about encouraging local production is really important, because we've got similar log jams in Europe politically with trying to get the fund and get the support that Ukraine needs. I think a concern a lot of us have is that this could come up every year. There could be a period of X number of months every year where there's political wranglings about getting the money, and then eventually it comes through. And each time Ukraine suffers on the battlefield because of it. I would concur with our comrades in Ukraine that perhaps a better approach is, well, what can we get the Ukrainians to build domestically and get it out onto the front line quicker? That might ease perhaps some of the questions that we've got. I'm not saying it will solve them entirely, but perhaps that's an approach to be considered. So they're two of my big sort of takeaways at the moment, if you like.
Well, you know, you mentioned kind of, you know, this issue coming up every few months and continuing on. I'm hopeful that, you know, through other channels of diplomacy, you know, we're conveying the right message that the aid is on its way in some form or fashion. I mean, so much of what we hear in the news today is, you know, it was just reported that, you know, we now have an agreement to fund the government here in the final appropriations bills for FY 2024. Of course, everyone knew it was going to go down to the wire. And so there's a lot of, I think, unnecessary drama around, you know, maximizing the political benefit of certain issues. And unfortunately, I don't think the war in Ukraine, Russia should be something that's politicized the way it is here with regard to aid, because each delay is, you know, it's affecting not just the outcome of the war, but the people's lives in Ukraine, especially and the tragedies going on over there. So, you know, hopefully through other channels, you know, we're conveying that the aid is going to be there at some point. But I think it's really an interesting. I like what you say. You know, we have to be able to get this new technology in the field faster. We have to be able to give assurances on many different ways, not just on the funding, but also how we're delivering technology. Matt, do you have anything you'd like to add on what Dr. Withington said?
Well, I want to go back to the article a little bit too. I want to kind of tie the two things together a little bit. You know, the article kind of, you know, implied that, I don't want to overstate it, but basically that, you know, Russia's currently winning in the EW. I don't know if that's true, right? So, you know, I still think it's pretty even, pretty stalemate-ish. You know, it's been 3 years already. I think what's happening, if I'm being honest, is I think that Russia has the ability to learn and modify some of the weapon systems that they have already at a pace that's faster than Ukraine. But I would still make the argument that most of the war, as you know, as Mr. Whittington said, is a whole bunch of drones flying at each other and then how to fight those things. And then if we don't have any drones, we just put a bunch of GPS jammers. Like, that's happening on both sides. So it's still very much a low-cost war, like, in that regard. So I don't think that, you know, magically one person is going to pull ahead and win, which is why, you know, the funding and the support and all of that is relevant. Why every few months, every few years, I don't really see, you know, an end per se on the horizon. So I think that's why it's an interesting debate for sure.
Could I just come in on a few points that...
Go ahead, Tom.
Sorry, I was just wondering, Ken, can I just expand on a couple of the points that Matt mentioned there? Because they were really apropos, I think. I mean, Matt, I'm in complete agreement with you. And I think, it's a difficult conversation to have without having the wider conversation of the people who are supporting Ukraine. How ultimately do they want this war to end? And I think that's a key thing, because I think that then affects the support that is given in the electromagnetic spectrum. I mean, the first point I would make is Ukraine or Russia cannot win this war without one of them winning and retaining control of the spectrum, achieving that spectrum superiority and then spectrum supremacy. And if that's the case, then how is that achieved? How do we support Ukraine to do that? Now, the other point I would mention is, if we want Ukraine, if Western support is for Ukraine to expel Russian forces from Ukrainian territory, if that's the war aim, then I would argue that that means getting the Ukrainian military as mobile and as maneuver focused as possible. If we cast our minds back to the first Gulf War, 1991, Desert Storm, the US didn't have the biggest military in that theater of operations. It was the Iraqis who had the biggest army. But the US and the US's allies prevailed because it got, I would argue, the war was highly mobile. There was a tight coordination of maritime, air, and land power. There was extremely good generalship. There was a clear political direction with what victory looked like. George Bush knew exactly what victory looked like, and so did the allies. And we all know what the outcome is. I think one of the problems that we face in Europe is that, without sort of getting too political about it, but I think in some of the political quarters, there's almost a fear that Ukraine could win. You know, there's almost this, oh my goodness, if they win, is Mr. Putin going to go truly insane? My argument would be, if Ukraine does win and expel Russia from its territory, and Mr. Putin chooses to take some sort of riposte about that, I would argue the risks for him are much bigger than they are for the rest of NATO. And I'll just sort of leave it at that. But I certainly think, you know, to echo Matt's words just then, yes, you've got a stalemate at the moment. And if you're going to move that logjam, then that route goes through the spectrum, and that also depends on decide what you want victory to look like, and then tool your support to achieve that.
Yeah, you know, Dr. Tom, you were talking about, you know, improving the maneuverability of your fighting force, and making sure that your total force is able to execute, like you said, a clear agenda, a clear path to victory. There was an article from Foreign Policy that, you know, talked about, you know, technology alone won't break the stalemate in Ukraine, and the article mentions that obviously there was a focus on digital battlefield intelligence, automated targeting, unmanned aerial vehicles, and this is not surprising, but they also credited this focus on this advanced EW technology and so forth as a reason for the stalemate, because it's so cat and mouse and countermeasures, it kind of creates its own stalemate because both sides are so adept at it. And so they were talking about, really, you know, it's alluring to put a lot of faith in technology, but it's no substitute for, you know, a maneuverability of a fighting force, a well-trained fighting force, to kind of come in and you know, execute the victory, the strategy of victory that you mentioned. So any thoughts on this? I did send this around. I'm not sure if y'all, I sent around late. I'm not sure if y'all had a chance to read it or not. Any comments on that?
Okay. Yeah. I think what it sort of illustrates is that EMSO is vital in Ukraine, but it's not the only answer. I mean, it is part of that combination of really good air land maneuver, really good coordination with the maritime space, and it's a vital part of it. And I think this I know we could get into a huge debate about whether the spectrum is a domain or not. I'll try and steer clear of that one. But let's call it the environment. I mean, I think it's impossible for either side to prevail without controlling that environment in some shape or form. Absolutely, it is a cat and mouse. EW has always been a game of cat and mouse, and it probably always will be. But let's look back at some of those previous conflicts. How did the US get to dominate the spectrum during Desert Storm? What steps were taken? What can Ukraine learn from that? It's not impossible. It can be done, but it's just a case of the right tactics, the right thinking, the right equipment, the right approach.
Well, and I think that what goes into this also is this need to establish air superiority from Ukrainian position, because unless you have air superiority, unless you can execute that, you're not going to be able to, you're going to be limited in what you can do on the ground to begin with. So, you know, it is multi-domain operations, and it's making sure that you're not just using technology to fight, but you're using it to control the warfighting domains, as, and particularly in Ukraine's case, I think we need to make efforts to help them secure air superiority. Matt, do you have any comments?
Yeah, I think that'd be great, the air superiority point, but I think that, you know, there's got to be a strategy that's, you know, start picking places off. How do we take space back? Like, how do we actually start moving the needle on, you know, right now, they're basically a pretty solid line of, you know, defensive posture on kind of both sides, arguably. So while their superiority would be great, like, I think there's got to be some more tactical decisions made and some ways to actually, you know, force some change. And I think that's really where the challenge is. You know, it's a good chance Russia wins on Monday, Ukraine wins on Tuesday, you know what I mean? But there's no like significant movement kind of either way. I think that's the real challenge. And I get it. That probably comes from a little bit of an, you know, an American perspective where we want to push and be offensive and get things over as quickly as possible. You know, but that lack of motion, I think, regardless of whether it's on the land or the maritime, I mean, you know, Ukraine has sunk a couple boats from Russia, which probably should have never happened, but it did, you know, but like significant movement hasn't really happened on either side. So, I think it's an interesting debate.
Another topic that I wanted to bring up, and, I saw this news article come up. It's a couple days old, but I just saw it across my desk today. And this has to do with, you know, the president's budget that came out last week. You know, the U.S. Air Force plans $28.48 billion over 5 years to develop new advanced fighter and drone escorts. And so the article is talking about Air Force plans on spending for the what they call the Next Generation Air Dominance Fighter Program in the coming years. And what's interesting about this is that this new fighter is going to be accompanied by what they call collaborative combat aircraft, which are uncrewed semi-autonomous escort aircraft that fly alongside the fighter. And they're it's these CCAs that will provide sensing, jamming, communications, EW support for the fighter program. And it's a kind of an interesting interesting plan to ultimately replace the articles at F-22. So, you know, wanted to get your, now I realize, Matt, you're with the Navy, so I'm sure you have very strong opinions, but with regard to the Air Force's plans to bring about this new next generation air dominance fighter program, you know, what do you think that means for the direction of the Joint Force and with this capability?
Yeah, so it's so funny. I actually was reading a completely different article. I just sent it to you about this happened recently within the past week or so, where the Army just canceled like their new helicopter program. So I mean, which was, it's a huge thing, right? So I think that, you know, cyanide-ing $20 billion for some unmanned planes to make match drones, I mean, like, it sounds great, but, you know, I don't know what that's going to look like. I don't know, you know, I don't know how we get there or what, you know, the vision is. So, you know, I think the DOD basically, and I wrote an article about this that's going to show up in the eCrow pretty soon about, you know, these really big contracts spending lots of money, and then they just turn the faucet off and industry's like, well, what do we do? So I think on paper, strategically, tactically, it sounds awesome. You know, do I think it's going to end up looking like what the article says? I think that's a far stretch. So I think it's going to be very interesting to see kind of how that plays out.
And it does speak to some of the incongruency you have between the services and their individual strategies and plans for next generation weapons, and that affects all the services. You know, what do we need to do to basically have that overarching strategy where the services are kind of held into account for some of these major decisions? Some of it has to do with the uncertainty of defense funding here in the U.S. And I won't bore Tom on how we mess this up every year. But, you know, when you don't have a defense budget until March of the next fiscal year, you know, you do throw off a lot of planning and programming and where the money goes to and some of the testing and so forth. And that can raise the price tag to a point where it's no longer supported by the service. So there's a lot of things that go into that. You know, Tom, you know, from your perspective, from a European perspective, I don't know if you're familiar with this program, but just in terms of next generation capabilities in Europe that you're seeing, what are some of the programs or ideas that are starting to come to fruition and say, hey, here's what we need in 2030 over in the European theater?
I think a lot of them are quite closely and quite similar to what you're seeing in the US. I mean, it's interesting, Ken, that you've mentioned the air power domain, this idea of having the inhabited aircraft, the UAVs, working very closely with each other, that sort of loyal wingman concept that was being talked about. That is being mirrored in Europe. We're seeing that with initiatives like the FCAS, Future Combat Air System, the Franco-German initiative, and Project Tempest, which is the UK, Swedish, and Japanese and Italian. I think I've got all four countries included in there. That joint initiative, which is, again, sort of taking sixth-generation combat aircraft and working out how that's going to be teamed with uninhabited assets. That certainly seems to be the way forward. And I think it's interesting that it does make sense to have a certain quantity of the mission set, if you like, hived over to uncrewed platforms. I mean, the EW mission is a classic one, and that's something that's being looked at very carefully. And I think this idea of being able to send high-performance UAVs downrange that have got very, very clever jamming technology on them, very clever EW, very, very good comms, and that they can sort of make life hell for an S-400 unit, whatever it is. Yeah, it's almost taking that SEAD mission to the next level, isn't it? It's the sort of moving just beyond an F-16 CJ and the AHAM targeting system and AGM 88 and support assets, obviously, as well, and taking it to the next level. The concerns I have, I mean, I suppose in a sense, come full circle back to the conversation we kicked off with, is the bandwidth challenge. I mean, one of the concerns that I have is that through MDO and other initiatives, we're continually adding to the number of electromagnetically dependent capabilities that we're deploying to fight wars with. Now, on the one hand, when I look at the diagrams produced by DOD, for instance, with things like JADC2, there is a lot of work going on into ensuring that the link budgets are sufficient, that there are, you know, redundant links that connect these systems, that they have the bandwidth, all of that. And that's really, really good. And I'm sure there's similar efforts going on in Europe. I think one of the challenges, as well as ensuring that there's the comms necessary to knit all of this together, is, again, linking outwards. If you've got whatever the US program becomes, when it becomes a program of record and then equips the US Air Force, for instance, and you've got a Royal Air Force Tempest fighter and they've each got their uncrewed assets, well, How are they going to talk to each other? How are they going to coordinate? What role does technology like AI have in that? What's the trust factor of the pilots with the AI? Matt, I'd be interested to hear your views on this as a fast jet guy. You know, how confident would you feel flying with, you know, effectively a computerized wingman supporting you on the mission? Because I think that the human factor question is one as well. So in order to come back to what you're saying, Ken, yeah, a lot of the issues, a lot of the discussions are the same. And I would love to be able to also tell you that, oh, we've got budgeting totally brilliant and we're really, really good at doing it on this side of the pond. But you know what? We have exactly the same challenges as yourselves. And I think that that's just a feature of politics that will probably always be with us.
And well, thank you, Matt. Do you want to have the last word here as we as our time is coming to a close?
Sure, I'll respond quickly. So I will. I don't know. Probably forever. Never be someone that believes in autonomous warfare. I think there will always be, at least from my perspective, a requirement for a man in the loop. And I've talked about that before. Where the man in the loop is, I think that's somewhat negotiable. I think that obviously, you know, we're doing everything we can with the use of drones and things to push the man further from the loop, but he's still got to be in there, right? Like if we get to a point where they're making decisions on their own and we're letting them fight the war for us, then we've missed the whole forest for the trees. So I don't think that's coming. I don't think, you know, everyone thinks that's where we're going. I don't really think that's true. I think that we're always going to have some level of oversight that's going to be required. Regardless of how good the technology is. I'm a huge believer that AI is still, you know, crap in, crap out, right? So, you know, and it's still just computer programs that are running really, really fast, trying to make decisions. We're still going to have some human intervention as long as it exists, I think.
Great. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for joining me here on From the Crow's Nest, our subscriber edition. It's a great conversation and greatly appreciate both of you taking time out of your busy schedule to join me here on the show. It's always good to hear from you.
Well, Ken, Matt, it's been an absolute pleasure. And hopefully, Ken, I know I'm going to be seeing you in Oslo. Matt, hopefully you're coming over too.
I wish that I was, but I'll be attending a different conference here. But I'm sure we'll get together soon.
Absolutely.
I will be in Oslo for AOC Europe in May. Looking forward to that. We are going to be doing podcasting from that location, and so I'm hopefully there'll be an opportunity, Tom, to sit down with you and some other folks at AOC Europe, have a beer, and kind of come to you come to our audience live from AOC Europe here in May. So be on the lookout for that. So that will conclude this episode of From the Crow's Nest. Again, if you're in the audience and, you know, we had some technical difficulties and some audio difficulties because of the internet connection, please download the episode when it comes out tomorrow, because as we download the audio locally on each of our computers, and so the sound that you will get here from the final episode released tomorrow is going to be crystal clear. So if you missed anything, you know, please download that. Also, again, right now we are making these episodes available to the public. So if you were unable to join us in the audience today, please go to crows.org to learn more about how you can join in to the audience in our next recording in 2 weeks. In a few weeks, probably in another month or so, we are going to be removing these episodes behind a paywall that will only be available to subscribers or AOC members. It is an AOC member benefit. So once we have that, then the attendance for the recording of these episodes will be limited to subscribers and AOC members only. But for now, it's public. Enjoy them. And we hope you are enjoying them. It's been a lot of fun to come to you in a slightly different format where we're talking a little bit more current affairs. And so I appreciate everyone that was able to join us here today. Also, don't forget to share, review, and follow our show. We always enjoy hearing from our listeners. Please take a moment, comment, rate us. And that means a lot to us in terms of hearing from our many listeners. And with that, again, thank you for joining me and have a good day. Thank you. Take care.
Vox Topica.
Fast Labs, powered by BAE Systems, is at the forefront of advanced technology and defense research, development, and production. They're pushing boundaries, breaking barriers, and innovating for a safer world. Check them out at www.baesystems.com/fastlabs.